In part two of this three-part podcast, Marvin Minsky continues his examination of the failures of AI research and lays out directions for future development in the field.
So let's talk about consciousness for a minute. And I can't discuss it much, but I just put a big essay on it on my webpage. So if you go to my main webpage and then type /E4, you'll get the consciousness page. And if you don't like something about it, I would love email about where you agree and disagree, because I'm trying to make it so perfect that everybody will agree with everything. At least I'm going to spend a few more weeks on it. What the chapter maintains, among other things, is that the reason consciousness has baffled so many people, especially physicists, is very simple. There isn't any such thing. Consciousness is a word that we use I call it a suitcase word, but it's a word we use as a name for a dozen very hard problems about how the brain or the mind works, which are quite different from one another. And in fact, if you go to school, which you've all probably done, do you remember anybody giving a little class where you talk about what is thinking and how does it work? Well, as Seymour Papert has pointed out, or what is learning, and you probably heard one of those. Have you heard the theory that to learn something, you should do it in little bits and not stay up all night working on it? If that were true, there would be no computer games. And I visited my lab the other night, and I was shocked to see nobody in it, and it occurred to me that maybe it's near its end of its useful life. So consciousness is a suitcase word, and among one of the most important things is keeping some records of what you've done recently, so if something goes wrong, you can think about which of the things you did might have been wrong. That's the credit assignment problem that I believe will be necessary for genetic programming someday to work well. Making descriptions of those events, and the rest of my lecture will emphasize that, how do you describe what happened? Well, you need some way to represent it, some kind of data structure, and I'll recommend 5 or 6 of them. And my thesis is the main reason, the two main reasons why AI hasn't made progress. One is that people haven't tried to organize common sense knowledge, but the reason they couldn't is that they didn't know how to represent it. And people are always arguing, should I use a relational database? Should I represent it in a neural net? Should I represent it as a fuzzy logic set? Should I represent it as a bunch of axioms in mathematical logic? The answer to all of those is no. You should use all of them. Use neural nets for things that depend on a whole lot of small inputs in a moderately additive, but not very interesting way, just weighting things. Use logic for something that depends only on a few very important influences, and if you change the value of one of them, the whole thing won't work, because that's the kind of thing that you will make out of nice ands and ors, and so on. I guess I shouldn't read the other 10. Making and using models of yourself, like reviewing the course of your ability to solve a problem, and you might say, well, maybe I should take a course in this, or if I don't get better at this, my friends will hate me, or really, if I did get better at this, I'd just be a nerd of some sort, and my friends would hate me even more, and so on. Hearing conversations in your mind, making new goals, adjusting your level of wakefulness, whatever that means. Back to learning. Recent discoveries in learning skills has revealed a very strange fact. Suppose you work very hard on something and then you're tested later that day on the same thing. It's interesting, you won't be much better. If you're tested the next day, you may be a lot better. And if you're tested the third day, you may be considerably better than you were on the second day without having done the thing in between. And guess what's the largest factor in influencing to what extent that's true? It's whether you got 8 hours of sleep or six. Have you ever heard of such a thing? I never heard of it till last week when a sleep researcher named Robert Stickgold, told me that this has been discovered in several places. Well, in school, when they teach you about thinking or learning, and what's school for? It's not to learn about Inuit culture or Egyptian culture or whatever bit of algebra or geography or whatever there. What you're really in school is to learn about thinking and learning. And as Papert has pointed out many times, we know so little about it, or the teachers do at least, that it's a taboo subject. You don't talk about it. And that's because we don't have good theories of things. So anyway, if you read chapter E4, you'll see that I think I am on the track, or E5, which goes into more detail. I have a theory of how to get a machine to do many of the things that go into the suitcase of consciousness, and there'll still be people who say, yes, but you haven't got at the unified central soul or spirit or magic of consciousness that explains all those other things. And my answer is, go back to the Middle Ages or stop bothering me, I'm busy. This is a diagram of the system I ended up with, which has five layers of things, including theaters, which are places where you simulate in one way or another what you think might happen if you were to do something. And then here on the side where you can't see it, because you could say, some people will say, well, consciousness, isn't that the central thing that's in control? And that's another disaster. There isn't any central thing in control. The anterior hypothalamus controls what happens if you're too cold or too hot. Anybody remember? And the posterior hypothalamus does the opposite. And each of those little pieces of brain, which are very tiny, have about 10 heuristics. Like if you're too hot, you will stretch out and you'll start sweating. And if you're smart, you'll go to an air-conditioned movie. That's using the higher, more reflective levels of the mind. So what I'm saying is that what controls what you do, is not centrally controlled. If some ferocious animal comes over here, that's going to interrupt me and I'll react with some primitive alarm system or other. And there are about 10 of those. The human brain is a wonderful kludge that has built lots of different kinds of control systems. And you shift from one to another, but some of your common sense says which you could shift to. If the alarm isn't loud enough, maybe you'll think, well, this is a real emergency. If I don't get this done, I'll lose my job and whatever you're worried about. So anyway, the way this book starts is the idea that the best way to look at the mind, at least when you start, is just think of it as a big cloud of different processes that are connected, and each of them has some functions. Each of them depends on a few others. And if you look at the brain, you'll see that there are about 400 brain centers. And there are a lot that we can't see because there are families of cells that are common to many brain centers that are activated by separate buses. And if you look in the brain, you'll see several hundred distinct large buses. And in only a few cases do we know what those do. But each brain center typically connects to 1, 2, or 30 different other brain centers and has almost no connections with the rest. So it's a big, complicated, highly evolved architecture. However, in the popular mind, there are very popular theories like the mind is two parts, logic and intuition, or reason and emotion, or left brain versus right brain. That's the very popular one, but there's really no basis to it. It's true that there's more language in the left brain in most people. But there are children with a certain kind of epilepsy have to lose a hemisphere. And I know a 9-year-old who lost his entire right brain when he was 3.5 years old. He's a superior achiever in his class. He can't see on one side of his visual field, and his left hand isn't very good. But he's charming and sociable and makes great drawings, and he's fine. So one should know that before you believe people. I don't have a clock. Okay, so maybe I should go both ways. Ooh, I hate that. You never know what it's saying. In the old days, there were a lot of little lights, and you could see if your computer was in the loop or hear it. So one thing I emphasize a lot in this book is this idea of multiple representation. If you understand something very precisely in one way, see, what does the word understand mean? Or what does meaning mean? And it's a difficult word because there's a kind of philosophical trouble with it. Here's what I think understanding is. If you understand something exactly one way, like if a child is... Most of you are too young to remember the new math where you were told about the empty set and that the number one is the set that contains only the empty set and stuff like that, and that was the right way to define numbers. Well, of course, numbers are also ways of expressing the size of things and the importance of things, and you use it for all sorts of different ways. So if you understand something in only one way, then I claim you don't understand it at all in the following sense. You know it by rote. Maybe you have a sentence. Hendrik van Loon had a child in some story in a 19th century children's book, whose name I forgot. And this child had learned that the Nile is the longest liver, the longest river in the world. And his teacher said, "What's the longest river in the world?" And he couldn't answer it. But then she prompted him, "The Nile is," and out it comes. So you would say that this child has memorized or learned by rote something, but it doesn't understand it. And what's the point? Well, if you have several representations of it, like if you think of the Nile as a river, and maybe you have a mental image, if you have those, not everyone does, of this river going much further than some other rivers. That's nice. And you might have a haptic image of swimming in it and realizing you're never going to get to the end and you're going to die. Images like that are very good for helping you remember stuff. So each of you has probably a dozen different ways to represent a river. There are some haptic ones. There are things you use a river. There's the river as an obstacle that you need a tunnel or a bridge to get across, an airplane, and so forth. And the point is that if you have 10 different meanings or representations of a river, then when you hear somebody talking about it, you won't get stuck. You see, you'll probably get stuck, but in 30 milliseconds or less, you'll say, "Oh, I've got the wrong representation. I'll switch to another," and you scan through 5 or 10 of them, and all of a sudden, you know what they're talking about. So this is why philosophers and very literal people have had trouble with words like meaning and understanding because of this joke. If you understand something in just one way, then you don't functionally understand it at all. And throughout this book, I use the idea suitcase word of saying that, now this isn't quite the same thing, but sometimes we don't understand something because we falsely assume that there's an it there rather than a collection of, or a network of interrelated processes. And it's hard to put those in a definition, especially a logical one. So understanding means having many ways to deal with things. And I can't remember what kind of crazy search found this. It's from Aristotle's Metaphysics. And I was looking for something to see whether he had this idea. I will actually read it. "The essence of a house is assigned in such a formula as a shelter," some piece of software has clipped off the right letter of some words, "a shelter against destruction by wind, rain, and heat. But a physicist would describe it as stones, bricks, and timbers." And you see the difference. The first one is a functional definition. The house is to keep the rain off me. The second one is a structural description. It's something supported by something else and has a certain structure. And Aristotle says, but there's a third possible description which would say that it was that form in that material with that purpose or end. And then he says, which then is entitled to be regarded as the genuine physicist, the one who confines himself to the material or the one who restricts himself to the formulable essence? That's the function, I guess. Is it not rather the one who contains both in a single formula? I'm trying to figure out how the E got into contains, but I got it from the Gutenberg. What? Oh. Okay. I'll check. Okay, so here's an example of multiple representation, not in terms of different data structures, but you might use the same data structure in different realms of concern. John gave Mary the book. And I discussed this example actually in my old book, The Society of Mind, and I'm trying to figure out how much of that section to copy or how much to write new. But you see, whenever you see something happen, you can think of it as purely physical, as Aristotle said. Ah, Charles has changed to John. That's my fault. Anyway, John gave Mary the book, so first it's in John's hand, and you might imagine a physical transfer script where it moves to Mary's hand. There's another one which I'm thinking of calling Dominion. Did you notice that wherever you go in the world, whatever you see, you can't have it because it belongs to someone? It's very important. Almost everything belongs to someone, including the air in some science fiction stories. So what's happened is it looks like the control of the book has passed from John to Mary, but we don't know whether he's loaned it or maybe it was hers all along and he's giving it back. And as soon as you hear that, perhaps different parts of your mind are looking for different answers to resolve that ambiguity. And also there's been a change in the memory of John and Mary, because unless he's like me, he probably remembers who he gave the book to. Anyway, I conclude that chapter showing a dozen different ways, kinds of data structures that you could use for representing things. A lot of these data structures depend on each other, so you talk about very low-level neural nets or even lower-level connections between things that I don't want to talk about. Things I called K-lines, semantic nets, which I think are actually about the richest representations for problems you don't understand yet. And that's what relational databases have in them. And then the kinds of frame arrays and transframes and scripts that I talked about in Society of Mind. So the moral of all this is that when you have a new problem and you say, what's the best way to represent this? Should I use a neural net or a relational database? The answer is, well, if you're just trying to get something done quick and it doesn't have to be very good or resourceful, then I'll suggest a way to pick one. But if you're looking for something in the future that's like a baby machine that's going to keep getting smarter, then you better not have it learn by statistical associations or neural nets or whatever. But you probably should start it off with five or six of these things and figure out some way of negotiating and managing that the different representations give you alternate ways of using the same kind of knowledge. Well, I said this already. Then on somewhere in my webpage, you'll find this diagram, which I'm very proud of, although it's been around since, I think, 1993. And this is a little diagram to suggest why it's sometimes better to use neural nets or fuzzy logic, and why it's sometimes better to use logical reasoning. And this is just a handy theory. You look at this problem, and my favorite example is you see there's some property of a situation, and you ask, what does it depend on? Does it depend on a large number of small causes or a small number of large causes? So what keeps this chair off the floor? It's four legs. And then you can do logic. You can say, if that leg were missing and there were a little force here, it would tilt that way. And if the front two legs were missing, then it wouldn't need any force. It would just fall and so forth. And neural nets won't do you any good with that. Or if they do, they'll waste a lot of resources. On the other hand, what keeps this jacket on the table? Well, it's probably 5 or 10 million little linen fibers touching the surface and each pushing up with a few milligrams of force. And if 10,000 of them were disappeared suddenly, you wouldn't notice the difference unless you wouldn't notice the difference. And so that's a good place to use a neural net-like thing. So I call this the theory of causal diversity. And what annoys me, it's not that I like this theory, but I've been peddling it, and I'm saying, tell me a similar theory for when it pays to use a genetic algorithm or a blah, blah, blah. In other words, what went wrong in AI is that people went off around 1980 in different directions. So somebody is doing grammar. Instead of grammar, they're doing statistical associations of words and clustering theory to find the words types and so forth. That's very nice, but I want to know, when is that better than using a simpler textbook type grammar? And what do you mean by when? For what kind of problem? If you're trying to transcribe a conversation that you dictated from hearing two of your roommates talk, you'll find that it isn't even made of sentences very much. People stop in the middle of the sentence when they know that you've probably got the idea and so forth, and then statistical things might help, or else something that represents conceptual ambiguity very graphically and clearly. What I'm saying is not that this is the right diagram, but how come you don't have 5 or 10 of them, and why don't people think more about that sort of thing? Let me put it another way. Artificial intelligence is, of course, nobody in charge of it, so you can't say what's it for. Clearly, some people are trying to make machines smarter at particular things. Lots of people do that. A few people are trying to make machines generally more resourceful. I only know about a dozen such people. And some people are trying to make theories of how the human mind works, and that's cognitive science. But in any case, if you look at those, you might ask a sort of higher-level question, which is, what are the kinds of problems that a person can solve? What are the big classes of problems? And I don't know. And so you see, the reason why this theory of causal diversity is nice is it says, well, in some problems, you're trying to understand an effect that has a lot of small causes. You see, all nine holes in this diagram are meaningful. If they're just a few causes and they have small effects, can you actually see that cursor? Well, then it's not a problem. So that's the empty square. If there's a large number, medium number of problems with small effects, then a linear theory will probably do, and maybe a simple statistical one. If there are a lot of causes with small effects, then you need some elaborate connectionist neural network or something like that, and it's hard to find anything else that will do. If there are small number of causes with large effects, then that's clearly logic. If you're in the middle, that's where classical, artificial, and traditional heuristic search worked. The chess program, there are a lot of, actually there's a small number of causes with large effects, but that small number is about 24, how many chess pieces are there? 32 pieces, and they're all interacting in rather horrible ways, and loss of a pawn has a large effect eventually. So classical AI handles those problems by big searches, perhaps. You could use case-based reasoning or analogy-based reasoning. And so this middle ground is where traditional AI was notably successful, but not very many people do it anymore. In this corner, the problem is hopeless. If there are a lot of causes with large effects, then you're screwed. But there's a way to get around it, which is to find a different representation. Like happened in physics when most people couldn't cope with the Heisenberg matrix formulation for quantum mechanics when there were a lot of variables. But if you put it in the terms of the Schrodinger equation, it looked much neater, and everybody felt better although if there were 20 variables, you still couldn't do a damn thing. But you could prove meta-theorems about it more easily. So making a new representation is the big deal if a problem seems hopelessly complicated. That's mostly what I wanted to say, but...